There we are. Welcome, everybody. We're going to be in Deuteronomy chapter 12. It's good to see you guys tonight. Thank you for the thoughts that some of you expressed and wishing us a safe trip. I think out of the 4 days we were gone, I think we drove up like 24 of those hours, just between up and back. But it was a good trip. Deuteronomy chapter 12 is where we're going to focus our attention this evening. We get into where Moses is going to begin, in a lot of ways, retelling some elements of the law. Some things they've heard before, but some things that need to be repeated as they're preparing to go into the land of Canaan. This evening's section is a bit longer than last week, so we're not going to start with our reading. We're actually going to start, as we've been doing typically, by thinking about the summaries. What do you find in each section of text? When you approach a text, specifically one that may be unfamiliar, like Deuteronomy is for a lot of people, okay, it's good to, when you first read through it, just kind of see what's there. What are we dealing with? What's going on? Okay. Then on your next time through, you begin to notice maybe some patterns. You begin to notice, you see a certain phrase a lot. Or, like in this text, you see a phrase that you recognize from somewhere else in Scripture. That actually happened today. I was reading through one of the Psalms, and I saw a phrase that was over in Ephesians. We're going to see that tonight as we go through. Let's begin with our summaries. Okay, this is the point where I like to hear from you all. What did you see when you read through the section? Okay, it doesn't have to be a word for word. Just in these, specifically in these seven verses, what did you find? Deuteronomy chapter 12, first seven verses. What do you see, or what did you see when you read through that section? What this also does is it thwarts the sit and get Bible study. You know the ones I'm talking about? Where you come in and you get unloaded on. That's not our Bible study. ours is a pitch in, it's not a cafeteria. Yes, sir. Exactly. So then that really takes up the first half of those seven verses, right? When you go in, he said, you're going to eliminate all those things that could distract you from God. What are some of the phrases that are used there to talk about how that elimination is going to come to pass? Destroy is one of them, okay? Utterly destroy, right? There's destroy and then there's completely destroy, you know. What others did you see?
Tear down, burn.
Tear down and burn, right? This isn't, we're going to move it somewhere else where it will be more suitable. This is, the scorched earth approach to idolatry. In the second half of that section, though, what do you see? It is. It is an issue. It cannot be just about getting rid of the bad. When you get rid of the bad and you leave nothing there, something will fill the void. Right? Nature and religion both hate a vacuum. Something's going to come in and fill that void. And what's supposed to fill that void, as you can see there, he begins about halfway through that section, I think verse 4. But you shall seek the place that the Lord your God will choose out of all your tribes to put his name and make his habitation there. There you shall go, and there you shall bring your burnt offerings and your sacrifices. And he continues with all of those things that we are familiar with because we've seen at least a cursory examination of the law. We recognize a lot of those elements from our studies in Leviticus. At the end of that section, following all of that, they're going to eat before the Lord, and then what? What's the next verb you find there?
Rest.
Rest? Well, just yours says rest. Oh, you've not yet come to your rest. What does it say around verse 7?
Rejoice.
Eat and rejoice. God sounds like a God that's good to serve. And not just because we like to eat, but eating is life, right? You have to eat to live. You're not just going to eat, but you're going to rejoice. You and all your households. And you see there at the end in which the Lord your God has blessed you. You're going to drive out all those things that distract and dissuade you from following God. You're going to fill up that with following God. And in the result of that, you're going to eat, rejoice, be blessed. Okay, this is kind of the basic pattern that we're used to seeing. Okay, what do you see next in 8 through 14? There is a phrase in that section, I think it's verse 8. Everyone doing whatever is right in his own eyes. That's never a good sign. Universally, that is a bad sign, right? That phrase serves as a bookend to the last section of Judges. In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Okay, it's what Judges chapter 17, verse 6, and chapter 21, verse 25. You see that at both ends of the section. And in the middle of those is awful in the book of Judges. You've got just terrible things going on, right? And that's why. So he tells them here in this section, you're not going to be doing that when you come to your rest, when you come to your inheritance, when you come to Canaan. You're going to go over the Jordan, live in this land. God's going to give you rest from your enemies. Okay, again, serving God is a good thing in Deuteronomy. There, you're going to go about these burnt offerings and sacrifices and so on. Again, right in the middle of that section, you shall rejoice before the Lord your God. You and all those who are with you, right? Don't do this according to what you think and according to what you feel is best. Some would look at that and go, well, that's, you know, infringing on my freedoms. If you set out worshiping the creator of the universe, you better listen to him, what he has to say. Right? This isn't about freedom. This is about what's best for them. God's looking out for them instead of holding them down. Right? We've got to get that image in our head. Okay, 15 through 28. I know we're kind of breezing through, but what did you see? I broke this up badly in the book. I have a typo. It's supposed to be 15 through 28 as one big section. I think I put 15 through something else. But you have a consistent theme through these verses, from 15 down to 28. There's at least something that's repeated in both paragraphs. What'd you see?
You shall eat, you shall not eat.
Okay, more of these eating restrictions. Although this time it's not clean and unclean. Okay? They're told they can eat. What can they eat? Meat. So let's do a little logic. If God's telling them, you may eat meat, were they not allowed to eat meat? All right. The answer is it depends what kind of meat you're talking about. Okay. There were some animals they just could not eat whatsoever, right? Sadly for them, pigs were on the list, right? Pigs are delicious. But then you had two different types of clean animals. You had clean animals that you could hunt, right? Venison and rabbit and so on. And then you had clean animals that were domesticated, right? Lambs and goats and oxen, that type of thing. In Leviticus chapter 17 and verse 3, there was a law that was practiced during the wanderings. Okay, Leviticus 17 verses 3 through 6, you can read this on your own as well. But essentially what the law was during the wanderings, all of the domesticated animals, the lambs, goats, and oxen, if you were going to kill them for food, you first had to present them at the altar as a sacrifice. Does everyone follow that? So you weren't allowed to just eat any of those animals when you wanted to during the wilderness. If you wanted to, you had to bring it to the altar and kill it as part of a sacrifice. And in so doing, you wouldn't really get much of it back, according to the way the Levites were allowed to take some of it. So if all of Israel is under this restriction, did they eat a lot of meat? Do you suppose? If every single animal you killed had to be brought to the altar? They didn't eat a lot of meat during the wilderness wanderings. Nor did they have to. Remember, they had manna. They weren't short on food. It does lend some sense to why they were craving meat so much in the book of Exodus. Right? It kind of fills in that, why all of a sudden do they desire meat? It's because it's really hard to eat meat in the wilderness. It would have been really prohibitive to do that. However, when they get to Canaan, what are they allowed to do? According to this text.
there's one big restriction, but there's a huge freedom now. Now you can eat meat. Yep. All of those things you weren't allowed to eat in the wilderness, or it was prohibitively difficult to eat in the wilderness, you can now eat to your heart's desire. Provided you do what? You pour out the blood. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. They could eat the clean and the unclean meat of it as of the gazelle and as of the deer. So what they're saying is, in the same way you used to eat wild animals, now you can eat domesticated ones without bringing them to the altar. Okay, so this is a huge deal for Israel. Their menu just opened up, right? With good reason. They're going into the land of promise, where they're going to have flocks and herds and the ability to really take care of them better than they do now. So God is this is a huge blessing He's giving them. Now you can do this, provided you don't eat the blood. Why couldn't they eat the blood? Life was in the blood. That's an old law. That's Genesis chapter 9. Right? They were given the ability to eat, but they could not eat the blood. The life is in the blood. That's a really old phrase. Down around verse 23, 24, that area, three times it says almost in a row, you shall not eat the life with the flesh. You shall not eat it. And then further along, you shall not, again, don't do this. Okay? This is not what you're allowed to do. You pour it out. And at the end of that section, be careful to obey all of these rules. Okay, so they're given a big freedom. That freedom comes with a responsibility. Don't eat the blood. Okay, it's not new to them, but it's a reminder. Okay, 29 through 32, the last section of chapter 12. We get a bit of a change of topic here. What do you see at the end of chapter 12?
Stay away from strange gods.
Stay away from them, all right? How might they be tempted to go after those strange gods, according to the text? Hey, I wonder what Joe Canaanite's over there doing. I wonder how he worships his God. Oh, that's neat. And I'm being a little silly here, but can we say, for the sake of the children in the room, that the Canaanites had a very attractive way of worshiping their idols, a way that would perhaps be persuasive into how they worship their idols? And you can pretty much guess what it might be. There's a reason why God describes it later on as adultery, because He's not far from the truth, okay, in terms of what they did. Don't go snooping around in Canaanite practices for how to worship God. Okay, those two things are never going to go together. They're never going to gel together. A lot of Israel's problem throughout their history wasn't that they just wholesale abandoned God and went after Baal. It was they worshiped God, but then they mixed in elements that they wanted. Right? Doing this or doing that. They tried to blend the two, and it was distasteful to God. You see there, for one, verse 29, the Lord's going to cut off those nations. They're supposed to be gone. So don't go after what they do and inquire about that. The Lord calls it every abominable thing that the Lord hates they've done for their gods. For even they burn their sons and their daughters in the fire to their gods. Okay, something that was happening even in certain places at the time of Jesus. They were still doing this. Okay, there are reliefs and images from Egyptian idol worship, from other religions, of them doing this very thing, right? Throwing their kids over the wall because an army's coming and they think it's a sacrifice. Things like that. Don't go looking at that stuff. Yes, sir?
Remember from chapter 19, he said, teach your children and continue to teach them as you go forward. They're less likely to say, that's pretty neat.
Yep.
Say, no, that's not neat.
Remember earlier we said religion loves a vacuum or hates a vacuum? If you're not teaching them, they're going to figure it out from somewhere else. And it might be this sort of practice. It's actually indeed what happened. The last phrase of chapter 12 is really important. Sure. Okay.
Part of it is the meaning.
Yep. Yep. It's an excellent point. Don't forsake the Levites. They're not going to have these, you know, this ability as you do to have all these animals. They're going to have some, mind you, but not like, you know, someone living out in the tribes could. Don't neglect them. Absolutely. I'm glad you mentioned that. Okay. Like I said, into chapter 12, you have a familiar phrase, everything I command you to do, you shall be careful to do, you shall not add to it or take from it. That should be a familiar idea. 13. Chapter 13 begins, well, before I say it, did anybody notice the kind of the common way all the sections of chapter 13 started? They all start with the same word, if. And I mention that because it's a structural thing. It breaks up the section into reasonable, understandable chunks. 1 through 5, if a prophet or dreamer of dreams arises, gives you a sign or wonder, and the sign or wonder that he tells you comes to pass. You might think, well, that's pretty convincing. What are they to do with that person? Kill him. Even if what he says comes to pass, if it does come to pass, what's God doing? According to that section, he's testing you to see whether you'll be faithless. Even a sign or wonder fulfilled is not reason to forsake God. Paul said something similar in the beginning of the book of Galatians. He says, even if an angel from heaven brings you a different gospel, don't believe it. Right? Even something that will appear to be miraculous is not cause to forsake God. It's not a good reason. Yes, sir.
That's some of what we think about when we consider cults, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And they may have people around them that can do very clever things, but they can appear that there's miracle or happening in all this. But ultimately, it's going the wrong direction because it's going against God and against what God would want anyone to do. Clearly, not in agreement with the scriptures. So, this, we don't have.
We don't.
Move towards removing them, but you know, that just means that we have to be more careful and discerning, right? And effectively close our ears off to that or close our eyes. The New Testament talks about pulling out your eye.
Yep. Yeah, it's an excellent point, and I'm glad you mentioned that this is a law specific to them, right? This is in the context of this being their national religion, and part of their law code as a nation was this. So you have a blending of, you know, what we would call criminal and religious offense here together, which is not true in the kingdom of Christ. It's a different thing. But it does tell you the attitude you have to take with this. It's absolutely not. Right, this is the highest penalty. Kill the person. And he mentions there, you shall walk after the Lord your God and fear him, keep his commandments and obey his voice, and you shall serve him and hold fast to him. Right, that's the underlying sort of note that's playing the whole time. Stay with God. But you have these different reasons that are brought up as to why someone might want to leave. They're purging the evil, it says there in verse 5. There's a familiar phrase here. Because he has taught rebellion against the Lord your God. Now here's the familiar part. Who brought you out of the land of Egypt and redeemed you out of the house of slavery. Where have we heard that before? Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt and redeemed you out of the house of slavery. Or something very close to that. It's the opening line of the Ten Commandments. Right? I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the house of Egypt, or out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. It's very, very close. You see it again. Where is it? Maybe that's the only time.
But when you see that sort of phrasing, it's a trigger, it's a memory thing. Oh yeah. That's our foundation as a people, Israel would think. God and worshiping Him and being faithful to Him. All right? Very good. 6 through 11. We change input here. Who is the one doing the misleading? Friends, family, right? Your brother, the son of your mother, or your son, or your daughter, or the wife you embrace, or your friend who is as your own soul. This isn't second, third cousin twice removed. This is your blood. They're all your blood, I suppose, but this is your family, your close family, even within your house. If they entice you, what do you do? Kill them. Stone them to death. Furthermore, we have an obligation that's not given with the prophet or dreamer of dreams. Who does it?
You first.
You start it. With the first one, we can, while we may not be comfortable with killing a person over this, we at least get the command. This one, I mean, to say it makes it personal is understating it. Right? It's really, literally close to home. With this, there's going to be some investigation that has to be done. Okay, and that would have been true for the prophet as well. They wouldn't have just said, oh, well, I think this, and then they kill him. You're going to have to go through a process of making sure this is the case. And you actually see a little bit of that in the next section, right? Where it talks about they're going to inquire and search and ask diligently. That same sort of thing would go on here. But the truth would be found out. And when that happens, you're going to stone this person. I said there was another one. There actually was. I missed it. It's around verses 10 and 11. It says, because he sought to draw you away from the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt and out of the house of slavery. Same phrasing as the beginning of the Ten Commandments. Right? It's that back to that foundational belief of an Israelite. They fundamentally belong to God. All Israel shall hear and fear and never do any such wickedness as this among you. If this happens, it doesn't have to be repeated often. Because you're going to get the picture. What about 12 through 18? What's the influence here? It's not a prophet. It's not a family member. It's a what? Okay. Okay. So we have we're going to have to investigate and see if they're actually thinking this way. Who is the they we're talking about in verse 12? It's a city. That's a lot of people. I mean, depending on how big the city is, but that's still more than, you know, the two examples we have beforehand. If there's a city of folks that have been drawn away by these, I like how it's worded in this version, the certain worthless fellows, right? I grew up here and, you know, so-and-so was worthless. It usually meant they were up to no good. They weren't of any good, you know, of no account. You might have heard that before. They have led astray an entire city. So what do we do with the city?
Burn.
Yeah. You Jericho the city. The same description here is given in Joshua and how they treated Jericho. Right? Even the same idea of offering it as a whole burnt offering. Right? Jericho was offered as a burnt offering. All of it, none of it was supposed to be taken. We understand what Achan did. That's why he got into trouble. If this is what happens in one of your cities, you're going to kill everything that lives in the city. You're going to burn the entire city to the ground, and you're never going to rebuild it ever again. Right. So you can think this is Jericho, Babylon. This is the ultimate penalty. Where do these three, or how do these three tell us about loyalty to God? What do they tell us about that topic? Because these are rather severe reactions. Yes. Fiercely loyal, zealously loyal, intensely loyal, however you want to put it. And not only that, but I think if these are the laws concerning, you know, falling away from God, your attitude towards other Israelites needs to be one of, you need to be faithful. Starting at home first. No parent reading this is going to want their little Israelite child to have to suffer this penalty. So suddenly all that, you know, when you lie down, when you rise up, when you walk by the way, all that now has a little more gravity to it. Because this is the penalty. Within your city, there's going to be no tolerance for any of this. And that's the idea. We know this didn't happen. Not saying we don't know it wasn't fulfilled, but Israel didn't maintain that ideal. They relaxed, they mingled, they mixed, they, you know, little of this, little of that, and eventually wound up forsaking God altogether. But this was what they were called to do. All right. Israel has to be unified. Everything has to be one. There's one law. There's one God. There's one place of worship. There's one way to worship. It's all singular, one. It's not a coincidence. We're told in the New Testament there is one body, one faith, one hope, one baptism. It's all still singular. It's all still just one. For us, it's a worldwide one. For them, it was Israel's one. But absolutely. Mm-hmm. Ty, you're next.
I'm sorry.
You're right. You're right.
Yeah, well, I guess it's kind of close to what now we're looking at. But, you know, it's interesting to me that in all of those cases, it says if.
Yep.
And not when.
Yep.
You know, God understands our weaknesses, certainly, if you wouldn't have given any warnings otherwise. But it's very important, I think, that we, and I think we as Christians should understand. Someone might look at this and say, well, how could God allow this to happen? You know, if he wanted his people to be strong, then why would he allow them to see visions? Why would he allow them to even know these other gods? And it correlates with James 1 in the New Testament when he says, if and not when these things happen, because we all have a choice. Every one of us have a choice, and I think that's what we're here for. We're all tempted by our own lusts. Someone doesn't become a dreamer because they happenstance upon it. They're seeking something else other than the standard.
That's a good point.
People don't go and encourage other people to worship other gods because they're staying with the standard. Now, they were enticed by their own lust. And you can apply it to each and every gift. I think it's really important that we understand that these are not God's ideals or allowances in the sense that he wanted them to be tested. He knew that they would make mistakes by their own lusts, just as we do today.
Yeah, they're... Before someone gets to this point where they're saying, let us go serve after other gods, they've crossed a few bridges already, right? This is open rebellion against God. Did you notice it was the same phrase in all three of those? Let us go after other gods. Let us go serve other gods. Let us go and serve other gods. This is, in all three cases, it's forsaking the God who brought you to Canaan. The penalty for that is severe. This isn't, I messed up on how much of a certain animal to offer. Those things would be dealt with, and there were ways to deal with that. There were things that were not capital offenses in the law. this was a capital offense, right? Forsaking God. It's really the highest offense. It's the offense that nearly destroyed them in the wilderness a couple of times. What else did you see? Ty, did you see something? All right, what'd you see? You got to speak up, though. I can't hear you. Exactly right. No, they did not. You're exactly right. It is a lot of warnings. It is Moses trying to tell them, and God telling them through Moses, if these things happen, you'll be destroyed. And on the other side of the coin, if you're faithful, did you notice how many positive things were in this text tonight? Right? In just descriptions of what's going to happen when you get there. Let me put up a few of these. I didn't put them in any specific order. Just things that I noticed as I went through. You want to notice sort of argument structures and how things are done, right? Don't do this, but do this, right? Not this way, but this way. You see it a lot. Okay, it's a really common way of writing, and we even use the same thing today. The first seven verses of chapter 12, you have don't do this, but do this, right? A not but sort of structure. It's interesting to me that this section really, in a lot of ways, begins the sort of more of the details of the law, you might say. Chapter 12, and then all the way really to chapter 26, is you have details. The details begin with worship. It's item number one in this section, this bulk of the book. Worship must be really, really important. Of course it is. Just the fact that it's first is a big deal. And so you want to notice that. In that first section, 12:1-7, you have the place where the gods are worshipped, the way the gods are worshipped, and who is worshipped are all described. They were supposed to destroy all of those things. But then when you get down to the section talking about what you're supposed to do with God, you're going to seek the place where He wants you to worship. You're going to worship Him the way He wants you to worship Him. And you're going to worship God specifically, Yahweh. Right? That is your God. He's the only God, but He is your God. You've got to worship Him specifically. He alone is the only one that gets to establish how God's worshipped. God says how God must be worshipped. That's a principle that carries true even today. We noted this when we went through. This freedom to eat animals had to have been wonderful. Okay, there's no more we're craving for meat. When they get to Canaan, they can eat really all they want. All they have the ability to eat. It's a blessing that, if you think about it, it's a blessing that Abraham had. Right? He was blessed with flocks and herds and could eat what he wanted. Israel now is going to have that blessing, which I think really neat. Three times I noticed that you don't eat the blood. Chapter 13 tells me God doesn't mess around with sin, and He expected Israel to do the same. He does not tolerate this sort of rebellion against Himself. Time is always against us. When the shift starts to idolatry, I want to zoom out just a bit from the three examples because I think these three are helpful today for understanding how we forsake God. You have in the first case, something special happens. I won't say something miraculous happens, but something special happens, something unusual, something weird. And that can be a justification for, well, God must not have all the answers. We need to turn away. The second one, a close relationship turns a person away from God. That one happens, we know very well, even today. It's been happening ever since God was worshipped. Folks are influenced by those that are closest to them, and folks are led away. Right? That's one of the dangers of, for instance, you know, marriage. Because marriage introduces that such a close relationship that if one half of it isn't faithful to God, it can drag the marriage that direction. Right? That's something that's a danger. Thirdly, is popularity. Not just one person or a close person, but if a bunch of people feel a certain type of way about God, then that must be all right. No, it's not. God didn't look at the city and say, well, there's a bunch of them down there, I won't deal with it. God looked at the rebellious city and said, raise it to the ground. Right? Being faithful to Him is still ultimately important. Anything else that you noticed as we rapidly run out of time?
I have a question.
Sure. I might have an answer.
12:4.
Okay.
He says, you shall seek the place of the Lord your God, shall choose. And then again, 12:11, to the place of the Lord your God. Is this where they put the permanent tenure?
That place changes until it gets to Jerusalem, right? You have, if my memory serves me right, Shiloh, and then another place, and then Jerusalem. This is something that's specific to God. He only wants himself to be worshipped at one specific place. That would have been really different from the Canaanite gods. You could build an altar to a Canaanite god in your backyard, right? And often families did that. They had a family shrine or a family altar. A town could have an altar that they would use. A king would set up an altar or a statue here or there for whatever. You could worship an idol basically anywhere you wanted to. Not so with God. Right? Instead of having just multitudes of places, God says there's going to be one place. That one place is going to be wherever the tabernacle is, which is going to eventually get to Jerusalem, and then they're eventually going to build the temple there. But that would have been a big difference. Not just you have to worship me the way that I say, but there's going to be one place for that. You remember I always get this messed up. Rehoboam, Solomon's son. I always mess up the two. That was Rehoboam's folly, right? He built two altars, Dan and Bethel, and said, you can worship God here. That's completely out of the question, right? Only one place. Tie the bell ring, so we'll have to do it next time, all right? He goes, okay. Next week, let me get to my next week's slide because I got to skip all that. 14 and 15, all right? We're going to press on through the book. Lord willing, we'll be able to talk about that next Wednesday. I did want to mention one other thing, too. We have yet to get to the discussion questions. Just the enemy of Bible study is time. But if you have a question about one of those, I'd be more than willing to answer it. All you got to do is let me know. Okay? I try to include them in the slides. If there's a specific one you'd like to know more about, I'm all ears to try to answer it. But it gets away from us. But that's why we have to study outside the room. Right? Because if it's just how much we can do in here, we're limited to 40 minutes or so. At home, we have more time. Right? So I provoke you to further study, hopefully. I'm going to go back and shut the recording off, and then I'll come back up here. Lily, you got to put your hand down.